One of my first acts as president will be to repeal and replace disastrous Obamacare, saving another 2 million American jobs.
And that was on the campaign trail. Sounds simple, no? This was last week.
Now, I have to tell you, it's an unbelievably complex subject. Nobody knew that health care could be so complicated.
Nobody knew. Health reform, complicated. Who could have even suspected such a thing?
I know more about ISIS than the generals do, believe me.
Well, maybe not that either, but that's another show. This week, House Republicans announced and President Trump endorsed a partial Obamacare replacement bill. And yeah, it's complicated. Complicated enough that it has now drawn opposition from the American Medical Association, the American Hospital Association, the Catholic Health Association of the United States, the AARP, basically everybody on the left, and some critics on the right who call it Obamacare Lite.
Now, I have to tell you, it's an unbelievably complex subject. Nobody knew that health care could be so complicated.
Nobody knew. Or everybody knew, except you. We talked on yesterday's show to a critic of the bill from the Progressive Community Service Society. Now we'll hear from a supporter of at least one key provision that House Speaker Paul Ryan is really excited about.
It has a Medicaid per capita block grant. That's the biggest entitlement reform anybody has seen here for decades.
Ryan at his Tuesday news conference. Medicaid today is a federal entitlement program. If you make very little money, up to $16,000 as an individual, $34,000 for a family of four in the states that took the Obamacare Medicaid expansion, you know you can get basic health insurance benefits from the government. That's 74 million Americans today. Under this reform, that promise would be gone and health insurance for the poor would be launched as a political debate in the 50 state capitals with fewer federal dollars to back it up. With me now to argue for that idea is Orrin Kass, senior fellow at the Conservative Manhattan Institute think tank, a frequent critic of Donald Trump, and a critic of much of this bill, we should say, but he's for the Medicaid block grants. Hi, Orrin. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. Great to talk to you again.
And Democrats hate this idea for so many reasons. I don't have to tell you. I barely know where to start, but I'll start here. This is from an op-ed today in the Chicago Tribune by Andy Slavitt, the former administrator of Medicaid and Medicare for the federal government. He wrote, "Medicaid pays for nearly half the births and half the long-term care in this country, to say nothing of the millions of Americans with disabilities who rely on it. If the federal government retreats on its commitment to Medicaid, the repercussions will be felt quickly by our neighbors and by our care providers and hospitals." Why not, Orrin?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that happens a lot with the Medicaid debate is something that we hear in a lot of spending debates, where anytime someone talks about pulling back on spending, people jump to whatever the best use of spending is and pretend that that will be cut. So when you talk about cutting a city budget, suddenly the mayor says, oh, well, then we're not going to have enough firefighters and policemen. Well, actually, there are other things you could cut first. And that's what happens with Medicaid as well. Medicaid does a lot of different things. One thing it does is provides health insurance for low-income children and pregnant women. And that's something that has had long-standing bipartisan support going back decades, and that Obamacare didn't touch at all. Another thing it does is provide long-term care for the elderly, and that's an area where actually spending has not been growing particularly quickly. But then it also does some other things. One, and this is what Obamacare did in particular, is seek to just provide coverage to able-bodied adults with lower incomes. That turns out to be very expensive, and unfortunately, the results also show that it doesn't actually turn out to improve health very much. It's not where low-income individuals typically spend their own money, or you might infer would want to see support for them spent. It doesn't achieve what it's supposed to, and the cost of it has spiraled out of control because of the way the program is structured. So the reforms are focused on actually making sure we fund it in a sensible way, and then letting states prioritize who that spending should go toward. And pregnant women, young children, and the elderly would presumably be right at the top of that list.
Let me follow up on a couple of those points. When you said long-term care is not expanding fast as a Medicaid expense, I would imagine it would be expanding very fast because the elderly population is growing so fast, and that's who gets the long-term care, right? Poor older people who need home health aids and things like that. So why would that be true, that particular Medicaid expense is not growing quickly?
Well, the thing to keep in mind is that there are two ways to drive up the Medicaid budget. One is to enroll more people, and another is to actually spend more per person. The elderly, as you said, as more people retire, we're seeing more people move into the program. But actually, states have been adding children, adults, and disabled people at just as fast a rate. So the expansion is by no means driven by the elderly. And then when you look at how much it costs, actually caring for the elderly has not been increasing. In fact, per enrollee, Medicaid spending has been declining. And that's in part because, as you said, a lot of the care they need is less high-cost health procedures and more things like the long-term facilities themselves. You know, the elderly is also a group for which you see enormous ranges from what some states to others end up paying per person. And so that's another opportunity to say to states, you know, look, we can see that there are plenty of states that are able to do this and help their elderly populations for a lot less cost. So maybe take a look at that before crying that any changes to the program are going to leave people out on the street.
And listeners, some of you are starting to call in already. You can call in and talk to Orrin Kass from the Manhattan Institute, who's making a case for block granting Medicaid to the states. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. The other thing I wanted to follow up on from your earlier answer was you said money is being spent on able-bodied adults without insurance, and they're expensive. Why would we exclude able-bodied adults if they're low income enough from getting, you know, with the government health insurance that is Medicaid? Where else would they get it if they can't afford it because they're low income, even if they're able-bodied?
Well, the thing to understand about health insurance first and foremost is that announcing that you've put someone on Medicaid and therefore calling them covered doesn't actually mean they're getting good health care or that their health is getting better. And that's something we see when people do studies of this question. When they, you know, the best known study is from Oregon, where they did a full random assignment. They gave Medicaid to some people but not others, looked at what happened, and after a couple of years they couldn't find improvements in physical health. And that finding gets confirmed in studies done in other ways. You know, Yale actually did a fascinating study that found the less of your social spending that you put toward health care, the better your health outcomes are. Because while you can like the idea that calling someone insured is going to benefit their health, actually spending money on their education, their housing, their transportation, helping them get a job, those things turn out to be much better ways to help them.
That's if it's an either-or kind of choice situation. Go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah, I just want to add, it's critical to remember that it is either or. You know, Medicaid, because of the way the funding is structured, essentially states get rewarded for spending more money on Medicaid, but don't get rewarded for spending more money on anything else. And so what's happened is over the last, frankly, 40 years, virtually all of our increases in social spending have gone into Medicaid. Medicaid is now the majority of our safety net. Medicaid is rapidly eating up state budgets, forcing cuts in areas like education and welfare and transportation. And so then when you turn around and say, well, why don't we have money for other ways that we'd like to help low-income families, part of the answer is because we've had this blind political commitment to putting Medicaid first and just spending more and more money on it. And that's the core rationale for the block grant, is saying, wait a minute, let's not cut the spending, but let's cap this and actually force people to make some sensible trade-offs.
And I don't want to accept without following up what you said about insuring people, not necessarily resulting in better health. I'll go back and read those studies, you know, from Oregon and wherever else that you're citing. But it doesn't make intuitive sense. Presumably, having no health insurance is a risk for worse health outcomes because you don't get well care, because when you're a little bit sick, you don't go to the doctor, and then you're at risk of getting much sicker. You know that logic. So why wouldn't it turn out that way in real life?
Well, there are a few reasons. One is that having Medicaid insurance doesn't necessarily mean you actually get access to care. The rates that the government pays doctors are so low that a lot won't even accept the coverage. And so it can actually be very hard to get health care if you have Medicaid. Another concern is that actually, you know, being insured doesn't necessarily encourage people to be healthier. It can encourage them to be less healthy. And another reality to keep in mind is that all of these health reforms that claim that they're providing access don't actually do anything to increase the supply of healthcare providers. So if you're just announcing here are lots more people who are going to get healthcare and use doctors, but you have the healthcare system isn't actually any bigger. And so you end up facing trade-offs on that side where if some people are getting more care, others might be getting less. But I think it's actually important to look at the actual results we have from Obamacare as well. You know, you hear people like Bernie Sanders saying, oh, tens of thousands of people will die every year if we repeal Obamacare and if we roll back this Medicaid expansion. The reality is that not only do past studies show that Medicaid doesn't accomplish what people are saying, we can look at the first couple of years of the Affordable Care Act and see that mortality has actually turned around and is moving in the wrong direction, and the worst outcomes have been in the states that did expand Medicaid. So even on the merits of this particular federal policy itself, we're just not getting the gains that that the proponents are saying that we did or that we should.
That actually leads to an argument for single payer. I'm sure you'll hate this, but if there aren't enough doctors who are participating in Medicaid because the reimbursements are so low, and some of the other things that you mentioned, the proponents of single payer would say, look at Canada, where every doctor has to participate in the program. And so there is ultimate choice. When Paul Ryan or anyone else talks about the choice that's being limited under Obamacare because the private exchange policies are becoming few in some places and insurers are walking away. Well, if you have a single-payer system, you have the choice of any doctor in the country because everybody's automatically in the system. And then you take away the overhead of the private insurance companies. And, yeah, there's going to be rationing in the sense that the government is going to determine what's covered. But all our private insurance companies determine what's covered now, and they limit our choice of doctors to who's in network and things like that. So why doesn't this all become a big argument for single payer?
Well, I think it's very misleading, first of all, to say that if you go to a single payer system, people have more choice. You know, as you said, you just shift the basis for rationing. So typically in single payer systems, you actually, for one thing, you have a harder time in a lot of cases getting people to want to be doctors and getting investment in good hospitals and facilities and technology. And so you end up with less total supply of healthcare, and then you just ration it based on either if things are actually working well, just everybody waits in line a long time, or if not, you end up with a very politicized system.
But there's going to be rationing no matter what. I mean, that almost has to be a starting point of, intelligent conversation about health care and health insurance, right? Because we all get rationed if we have private insurance by our insurance companies. Some things are covered, some things aren't covered. And they're inspecting every little thing. And, you know, I'm sure you've heard the horror stories from so many doctors about how they have to do battle with the insurance companies to get this or that they feel is necessary for their patients covered or reimbursed. So that, you know, because there's not unlimited money to spend on health care. It's either going to be rationed by the marketplace or it's going to be rationed by our democracy, right?
Well, to your point, any intelligent conversation about anything has to start from the reality that there's a limited supply and we have to allocate it somehow.
Right.
That's not unique to healthcare.
Right.
That's not unique to insurance. And so I think it becomes a real problem when we say, well, hang on, let's hold out healthcare as this thing that we're just going to throw unlimited money at, even though, you know, particularly at the margin, when you're asking where do you want to spend your next dollar, especially where do you want to spend your next dollar to help a low-income household, should we really be spending the next dollar, let alone the next $200 billion on healthcare, or is that really just not going to provide much bang for the buck, we see?
But if the issue is choice, and now we're getting really beyond the Medicaid expansion or Medicaid block grant question into other things in the Ryan bill, if the issue is choice, and he keeps selling it as, well, Obama was limiting your choice because insurers were fleeing the exchanges because they weren't profitable enough, the private plans that we are under, if we have private insurance in this country, tremendously limit our choice, right? Because there is this pressure for them to save money by putting everybody, especially for the most affordable plans, into very limited networks of doctors and in plan hospitals. Medicare is so much broader. You know, there's so many more doctors taking Medicare and so many more hospitals taking Medicare. And so maybe that's a model.
Well, you know, I think a little of it comes down to the definition of choice. In general, in the U.S., when we talk about choice, we don't mean you get to go do anything you want with no consequences and no cost. What we mean is there's a market in which you have different options. And so in a market that worked well, the goal, and I don't think that the GOP plan necessarily achieves this, but when conservatives talk about real healthcare reform, what they're talking about is actually having a menu of different options that says, look, if you want to spend top dollar and really put a lot of your money towards health insurance, you can get a plan that really covers everything and lets you pick any doctor you want. That's more expensive. If you want a plan that is only going to cover a catastrophe and is, you know, maybe going to make sure you use the particular in hospitals and doctors it works with, that's a choice
right.
too, and that's going to cost less.
Yeah,
and that's
but,
the way
but
everything else in our society works. And the question is, does it make more sense to get healthcare working that way too, or to move to a system that says, no, this is really where we want government in the driver's seat?
And I think that's an honest answer. But I think what we're hearing from Ryan is, we're going to give you less cost because Obamacare policies were going up, and we're going to give you more choice because insurers were fleeing Obamacare. But really, I think you just gave an honest answer that if you're going to get insurance at less cost, it's going to be more of these bare-bone plans that the Republican plan wants to enable. And there, if you're going to have less cost, you're going to have less choice. That's just the way the market works, right?
Well, the question is what you're talking about when you say choice. I think, and as I've said, I don't think that the Ryan plan does this especially well, but the choice, given the way our healthcare system works, has to be first and foremost a choice about what kind of insurance you can get. One of the problems with Obamacare is it says we're essentially only going to have one kind of insurance, which is this very expensive insurance that has to cover everything. And that's where we've seen the premiums going way up. That's where we've seen the deductibles going way up. And by the way, that's where we've seen the majority of middle-class families that are supposed to be subsidized and able to buy insurance saying, forget it, this isn't worth it. And so one of the key things of that I think Ryan is attempting to do is say, hang on, let's at least allow different types of insurance products into the market so that you have a choice of whether you want to be spending tons of money on health care and tons of money on insurance for that gold-plated plan that lets you go anywhere, or whether you want to treat your health insurance as something that's really there to protect you in the case of a catastrophe. And by the way, if you do that, that means less of your money goes to insurance. More of it stays in your pocket or goes into a health savings account so that now you're not working through an insurer for your physical or for your typical appointment. Now, for those things, you're just paying for it like you pay for other things in the world. And in that situation, then you would have more choice.
My guest is Orrin Kass from the Manhattan Institute, and he's a critic of parts of the Ryan plan, but he's here to support the idea of turning Medicaid into a block grant program distributed through the states rather than a federal entitlement for health insurance for poor people. And I've been monopolizing you, Oren. Let me let a couple of callers in here. Philomena in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hello, Philomena.
Good morning. There is obviously a great deal to talk about on this subject, but I wanted to focus in on the block grant issue. I have a learning disabled adult daughter who is on Medicare, and she's on the Medicaid buy-in program. And I think the public is unaware of what a block grant means. So if you have, let's say, 10 people who are Medicaid eligible for a particular procedure, and that total, I'm just making this up, is going to cost $1,000, the federal funds will be there for it if those people are eligible for that particular procedure. If you go to a block grant and those same 10 people need the same procedures and the block grants only have $900 in it, then somebody's losing.
Right, and that's one of the most common complaints about this idea that we're hearing in the last few days. So, Oren, go ahead and respond to Philomena.
Well, you know, the reality is that what would happen if you only had those $900 is the state would have to choose whether it wants to spend another $100 on it. And again, that's the way almost everything else in our government and in our market works. You know, what we have right now is a system that says, state, you can decide how big you want your program to be. And every time you spend another dollar, Washington will send you a dollar or $2 or $3. And so as a result, states have an incentive to spend more and more and to not think about what's actually the best use of the money. And so if we say instead, look, state, you know, if that procedure is the most important one to you, by all means, put the federal money there. If you want to raise taxes in your state and put even more money there, by all means, do it. But let's actually make sure the people making the decisions are making those decisions because they're the ones with the money on the line. And that's going to lead to a better system than one that we have today, which says make the decision with somebody else's money.
Well, it's good to be efficient, of course. But here's a follow-up on Philomena's scenario that was in the Times today. With block grants pegged to 2016 spending, and I guess that's a fact we haven't stated yet, the size of the block grants to the state would be based on what the states spend on Medicaid today or last year. States that have growing elderly populations will have less money to spend per person as those elderly populations grow. That would harm seniors going forward in many states, is the concern. Those that have shrinking elderly populations, and there actually are a few states, would make out better. Why isn't that a legitimate concern, or is it?
Well, it is a legitimate concern, but I believe that, and there are many drafts and conflicting interpretations floating around, but I believe that specifically the way that Ryan and the GOP have designed this program is not to be a flat block grant, but to be a per capita block grant. And what that means is that we're not going to increase the amount of money that you get per person you have enrolled, but that if the number of people you have enrolled goes up in the exact situation you described, then you would be able to get more money so that you're not, so that you can cover the people who should be in the program.
Uh-huh. Oh, that would be different than my understanding. So that's interesting if that's true.
And that's historically the proposal has been a straight block grant that just says, here's your amount of money. It grows by a fixed percent every year, and that's it. But the proposal in the current GOP bill is what's called a per capita block grant, which means it's fixed per person, and you can't go and create new eligibility. You know, you can't sweep in whole different groups of people, but that if your defined group is growing for something like you mentioned, then the funding would grow with it.
All right. Well, this conversation is going to go on for a while as more groups and individuals weigh in on this Ryan proposal. I guess they want to call it, they used to want to call it Trump Care at the White House. Now they want to call it Ryan Care with all this blowback, even though the president has endorsed it. And the negotiations are underway, and we'll see if it actually gets through and how it changes. And we'll continue to cover it with many points of view on this show. Oren Kass, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, thanks as always.
Thank you for having me.